having three members and it being past 2:15, we'll start the committee meeting. And people from the Lake Superior Zoo are here. Yes, okay, thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you, Representative Kahn and the Legacy Committee, for inviting us here. This is my first time here, so if I don't quite follow the protocols or understand the protocols.
Okay, well, say your name so we have it on the tape.
Okay, that's Peter Pruitt, Director of Zoo Operations at the Lake Superior Zoo.
Okay. Thank you.
There you go.
Okay.
And we're here today to talk about a potential legacy funding project of ours called the Forest Discovery Zone. As we look around within our environment and our world, and especially in Minnesota and the United States, we are experiencing a very slow and methodical disease that has been occurring over the last several decades. We have until recently finally put a name to it, and people are beginning to call this nature deficit disorder. We don't quite know what the results of this disease is, but we know how it's happening. We've got families, adults, and especially kids who are no longer going outside and participating in natural play or natural events. They're staying inside. They're watching TV. They're playing on their computer. They're on their Nintendo, Xbox, etc. One of the biggest concerns we have with this nature deficit disorder is we've lost our connection with the environment. We've lost our respect of the environment, and we're seeing some of the results right now when we talk about climate change and the misunderstandings we have towards that, when we talk about the importance of clean water or conservation. We have a misunderstanding due to this deficit, and we at the Lake Superior Zoo are looking at ways that we can actually find a cure and fix this disease. And part of our forest discovery zone is a way to encourage people to go outside to play and to use informal classrooms and learning opportunities to teach them about the wonders of our environment. The amazing part about the Lake Superior Zoo is we've got about 10 acres on our northwest corner of the facility that we haven't been using. We're celebrating our 90th anniversary this year, and that land has never been touched. It actually is as close to natural native habitat as you can get. It hasn't been touched, and we need to take advantage of this and turn it into a exhibit and play zone where our educators and our community can come together and really enjoy and learn about the environment. We have other zoos within the AZA community who have attempted and actually built some very amazing and wonderful exhibits that take advantage of natural play. 2 years ago, the Toledo Zoo spent millions of dollars to develop Nature's Neighborhood, actually won an Exhibit of the Year award. They basically tried to mimic the habitat that we have right above us at the Lake Superior Zoo. We're not asking for millions of dollars. We're asking for $575,000 to actually take advantage of our habitats and turn that into an amazing, usable facility, which includes exhibits, etc.
Are there any specific questions, Mr. Pruitt? I do have one, which I think I got the answer from Representative. The zoo has restored its accreditation.
Yes, in 2011, we submitted our application for accreditation with the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, and we did receive that. Absolutely.
Okay. And it wasn't hurt by the flood damage?
The accreditation?
Yeah.
No. What was hurt was basically our Polar Shores facility.
Okay. That one of the things that I'm trying to get to do with a lot of our projects is trying to get some interaction with them. And we had you don't have any more building restoration in this WPA pavilion.
We're
with the old.
Flood kind of delayed the pavilion restoration project until this year. We have the prints, the specs are going out for bid, and we should be starting that project in April as soon as we can start getting equipment in there.
Well, one of the things we've had a couple of groups, well, one of the things we'd like to do is we'd like to put in some of these proposals, if possible, the extra credit or however we consider that for people who use other projects. And we've got a project that's doing historic, looking at doing historic funding of buildings, preservation of buildings.
Okay.
And that's kind of, and they use people from the community to do that. I don't know if they have any presence in Duluth. And the other place that has presence all over the state is the Minnesota Conservation Corps, which uses
correct right
young and adults, and one of the things we like to do, you know, probably just be a general thing in the whole bill, is try and encourage projects if they can to interact with these projects as part of their.
Absolutely. One of the things that we did last year, we worked with the Duluth Audubon Society chapter, and they restored a bit of forested land north of our zoo right below Interstate 35 in cooperation with the Stream Corps, and they used our zoo as the staging facility, and we donated a lot of our equipment and time to help them too. And with the Forest Discovery Zone, there's a lot of path building, habitat repair that we would incorporate as many local conservation chapters as possible.
Yeah. And is there the other thing that we're kind of looking for some of these locally based projects, is there any local funding connected with this? Is there any possibility of matching funds from the locality?
We are at the beginning stages of this, and so we would definitely look for matching funds, and we would look for funds to improve the project. You know, this is, in a sense, the base that we're looking at. We would like to develop a multiple series of exhibits. One of the things that we are trying as we develop exhibits are making examples of the human wildlife mitigation process, and a lot of that would be wildlife overpasses, underpasses. And so as our guests move through the zoo, they could pretend they're wildlife crossing an interstate on an overpass, mm-hmm. or, you know, have the animals pass underneath them, etc. So we would include that within this project too.
Well, one of the things I've sort of noticed over the years is that the effect of kind of requiring matching funds for a program has a salutary effect on both getting people, the public people feel very good about seeing private funds coming into it, and private funds feel very good about that their money is going to multiply the effect because it's connected to public funds coming in.
Oh, absolutely, and I agree with you, yes.
So we might be looking at that kind of wording, and if there's, you know, anything you could possibly help us with doing it, we would be interested.
Yes, and I wish I could give you the answer right now. We are in the process of developing multiple campaigns at the Lake Superior Zoo, some smaller, some larger, and so that's it. We understand that that's required, and that's in the process, yes.
Okay, because we really like the idea of the legacy donations specifically being tied to a private entity or the local unit of government or something in the area that would, you know, because then, you know, one of the things we have to, what I want this committee to think about this year is really the concept of creating a legacy and a continuing legacy. And the more we have buy-in when we have something that's a specific local, the more we have buy-in from the locality, the more likely that seems to be. But anyone else have any comments or questions?
I really do like about the Lake Superior Zoo is the fact that we have this amazing landscape, and our goal isn't to change it into something different. It's a matter of preserving it for not just the community of Duluth or Northland, but all of the state of Minnesota. And any project is considered long-term.
Well, I will tell you, because it's a long time ago, so it was a very different structure, but of course it was the only zoo in the state at the time.
Yeah.
No, I guess Como Zoo existed too. But the very first thing that we did when we moved to Minnesota, we moved to Minnesota from New Jersey, and I had never been west of Ithaca, New York in my life, so it was a whole new experience. And the first, we already had a place to stay, but our moving truck wasn't there yet, so we immediately took off for Lake Superior, and we went to see Lake Superior, and that convinced me it was okay to be away that far away from an ocean. And we also went to the zoo, and I was convinced, okay, it's not quite the Bronx Zoo, but
no,
you know, at least it's a zoo.
Right, it's
so
a zoo.
So those
time.
Are the first two things we did in our first 2 days in Minnesota.
I mean, it's a diamond that needs a little bit of polishing, but it's going to get there. You know, I hope that in the end we set the standards for smaller zoos across the United States. You know, we want to be a benchmark.
Okay. Representative Wills?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for the presentation. And I was just looking over the materials and just curious if you could expound on what interpretive signage is. And I saw it on both of the documents and the cost of $35,000 and what that's going to pay for.
Interpretive signage is one of those things that can really make or break your trip to a zoo. And these are ways to inform people of what they're seeing, what they're viewing, and educating our guests. And it's one of these, it's a science that zoos are now really starting to pay attention to. You don't want to put information in two paragraphs, because they're only going to read one sentence. And so with interpretive signage, it's a matter of trying to find and developing extremely creative ways to engage our guests into learning and participating in the entire event of the zoo visit.
Okay. Representative Byrne.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Pruitt, I'm sorry that I was tardy, but the day is getting away from us. And in your presentation, did you explain the connectedness of the zoo with Spirit Mountain and with Western Waterfront Trail and Bay?
Thank you for reminding me, Representative Mary Murphy. One of the nice, unique parts about the Lake Superior Zoo is that we sit right below the Superior hiking trails and right above the Western Waterfront hiking trails within Duluth. And Mayor Ness and the city is really focusing extremely hard on developing these trails. And we actually are within the Forest Discovery Zone, are looking at ways that we can connect the zoo to the Superior hiking trail and cross over Grand Avenue. And we will begin discussions with Minnesota DOT when they are redesigning the Grand Avenue across from us, and hopefully we can do a connection using Kingsbury Creek to the Western Waterfront Trails.
And Kingsbury Creek is located where, Mr. Pruitt?
Kingsbury Creek starts in the city of Proctor and meanders southeast towards St. Louis Bay, and it's part of the St. Louis watershed.
Why do I think these are leading questions somehow? Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, well, I remember so well that your earlier remarks in other committee meetings where you said you like things to be connected and that kind of thing. And what creek goes to the zoo?
Kingsbury Creek. Thank you, Representative Murphy. She knows this is my first time here, so she's helping me out quite a bit. We have right through the middle of our zoo is probably our greatest asset, and we learned this last summer it could be our greatest cause of concern, and that's the Kingsbury Creek, which is a certified trout stream, and it's considered an impaired body of water through the state of Minnesota. And that cuts right through the middle of our zoo. And the wonderful thing is this summer, between July and October, we are working with Minnesota DNR in removing a dam, which is on the southeast corner of the zoo, as part of the MnDOT Grand Avenue project. And we will be restoring probably the 1,000 to 1,500 linear feet of Kingsbury Creek back to its native.
Wow.
structure, and we are also working on that eventually to try to get the entire creek throughout the zoo restored back to its native structure. Right now we've got a lot of WPA retaining walls that were built 90 years ago on that creek, and it kind of helps encourage flooding within the zoo.
Because of this work and because of the floods at Kingsbury Creek, that's where the seals got away and went up on Grand Avenue, and that's why they ended up at Como Park, and that's why the bear had to swim so far that night, and that's why the bear ended up at Como Park, and now the bear is in Kansas City.
And Mississippi.
We may have that baby someday, and so we need to look at all kinds of things at the zoo to bring it into the new century, but keep the wonderful environment we have. And we could have the Civilian Conservation Corps help with that, couldn't we?
Absolutely, absolutely. What I see with the Forest Discovery Zone is we need to jumpstart our master plan, and we need to really find a very good, cost-efficient, highly effective way to bring our zoo up to world-class standards. And this is where the Forest Discovery Zone comes into play. We've never taken advantage of our natural habitat, and to be able to bring our community together out to the zoo and actually participate in the wild is really an amazing opportunity.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Brook, former Chair Krenke came up with his family to the zoo on the 4th of July on a capital investment tour once, and he was so impressed with the waterfall and with the path that was going up to the Skyline Drive, which is just above. And he thought that was a wonderful destination spot for people to come and appreciate the environment as well as the zoo.
Yes, I mean, the waterfall is great, too. We had our inspection, AZA inspection crew came in, and one didn't necessarily believe that we had a real live waterfall through the middle of the zoo. They thought we had created it, and nope, this is what nature gave us.
Well, are you going to take down those WPA walls?
We will be working with the Historical Society to see what we can and cannot do. There is a section that's actually right west of the Polar Shores building that when they remodeled the historic elephant WPA building into Polar Shores, they actually pulled those retaining walls out and then replace them again with very similar stone. So, and that's the section that is the narrowest part of the creek, and that is the section that historically will break its banks even during spring thaw.
Representative Hasman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And perhaps you mentioned this. I, too, was delayed in getting here. What happened to the visitor numbers after the loss of the animals?
We had pre-flood, we were sitting we were ahead of our previous high. In 2009, the zoo went from city-run to a not-for-profit, and the first 4 months of 2012, we were breaking records for the previous 4 years of our changeover. And then after the flood, we ended up with 75,000 guests for the year, where the year prior we were sitting right at 100,000. So we lost about 25%.
And Madam Chair, given the nature of the flood, there are some challenges in getting back in the queue for acquiring new animals. Is that correct?
That, yes and no. With the nature of the flood, we had to readdress and reassess how we looked at our Polar Shores facility. Presently, we do not meet every AZA polar bear husbandry standards for that building. It's going on 25 years. As long as Berlin, our polar bear, was there, she was grandfathered in. But the moment we try to bring in another animal, or as old age took over and we lost Berlin, we would not be able to bring in an additional polar bear because we didn't meet those standards. Me, as director of zoo operations, I also have to consider the health and welfare of our animals, but the safety of our keepers and staff and the safety and enjoyment of our public. And if we had an opportunity where, if we had an occasion where the polar bear did get out, that doesn't mean it will never happen again. And so we really had to look at what's best for the zoo, our staff, our animals, and the community, and we decided that that should no longer be an animal exhibit, and we need to look at ways to repurpose it. We've got a design concept already in place where we've taken Berlin's exhibit and her pool, converted that into an amphitheater. We don't have a spot where we can do educational programs or even entertainment within the zoo, and that amphitheater would be converted into a 200-seat facility, and then we'd also revitalize and repurpose the historic WPA elephant building into a cafe and gift shop. We don't have any restrooms or guest amenities on that side of the zoo, and we were looking at that opportunity to convert that into that. If the flood occurred again, we would just lose stuff and not necessarily animals or lives.
And Madam Chair, just one more if I could please. Acquiring any other animals, is that an issue, or is that just confined to, is the impact just confined to polar bears?
The impact is just confined to polar shores. Acquiring animals is the great part about being accredited within the institution. We get to work within the AZA community with 224 other zoos, and with our species survival plan programs, for instance, we sent our snow leopard Harry to Zoo New England for a breeding recommendation, and we brought in a young snow leopard from the Albuquerque Biopark Zoo. So there's a lot of movement across zoos with animals, and if I want to acquire an animal, we'll do the research, and then I'll start contacting other facilities and see what they have for availability.
Okay. We've had a quorum for some time, and so Representative Hausman has looked very carefully at the minutes and moves the minutes of March 19th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Minutes are passed. Okay, Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Pruitt, and Representative Murphy is such an advocate and a champion of the whole Duluth area, but the Blue Zoo in particular. And, you know, as a young boy growing up in Proctor, I spent time going between Proctor and the zoo, you know, down through the woods along Kingsbury Creek. A lot of us did that. And I've often wondered, Mr. Pruitt, if now seeing that what a mountain biking trail can do for a community that we have been fortunate with in Crosby, that would be a wonderful mountain biking loop between the Proctor Rec area along the Kingsbury, down to Kingsbury and back up.
Particularly if the polar bear was still there.
I know. It'd be a quick ride, that's for certain.
Down, not necessarily back up.
Not back up, right.
But oh. I just threw that out as a, observation and a suggestion.
Absolutely. One of the things, too, that we really like about the Forest Discovery Zone is that one of the things that we always look at is improving our attendance, and one of the areas that we are always weak on is during the winter. You know, Minnesota is an outdoor place, but they seem to forget that the zoo is still open. And with the Forest Discovery Zone, we've already put plans in that we would do snowshoeing classes, snowshoeing rentals. You know, we want people to use that area 365 days a year and get them out to explore. And we've even thrown some ideas about cross-country skiing classes too, anything to get people outside, active, and enjoying the environment.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, everyone.
Very informative. Okay. Next one is the Civic Education Coalition. Yeah.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Tracy Warrenberg-Lem, and I work with Kids Voting, and this is my colleague, Jennifer Bloom. Our colleague Orville Lindquist from the YMCA's Youth and Government Program is not able to be here today. He was working on a Model UN project. So we are members of the Minnesota Civic Education Coalition, which is a group of individuals and organizations that have worked together for many years, and we are focused on preserving Minnesota's civic heritage that passes along knowledge, traditions, and responsibilities to the next generation. Civic culture does not just happen, and it is not a natural state. Sandra Day O'Connor said, "Knowledge of our system of governance and our rights and responsibilities as citizens is not passed along through the gene pool. Each generation of Americans must be taught these basics." The Legacy Amendment was passed to preserve Minnesota's history and cultural heritage. Civic culture is shared by all of us. Minnesotans want to continue investing and preserving in what matters. It was Minnesota's commitment to its strong civic heritage that contributed to the passage of the Legacy Amendment in 2008, and it is this heritage that we must continue to preserve. Minnesotans, we've been very fortunate. We've been the beneficiaries of a robust civic society from those who came before us. We enjoy a national reputation for our civic culture. For example, in 2012, nearly 76% of eligible Minnesota voters cast a ballot, which was once again the highest in the nation. This is not by accident. In fact, in a recent CNN online article, it stated that Minnesota has consistently high voter turnout with virtually no evidence of unlawful voting, and attributed it to, and I'm quoting, Minnesota's civic culture. Despite Minnesota's great civic heritage, we believe we are at a critical moment. When Benjamin Franklin emerged from Independence Hall at the close of the Constitutional Convention in September of 1787 in Philadelphia, a woman asked him, "Well, doctor, what have we got, a republic or a monarchy?" And I'm sure you all know, Mr. Franklin replied, "A republic, madam, if you can keep it." Keeping our republic involves educating the next generation about government. And reaching that next generation of citizens must take place in our homes, in our schools, in community centers, online, and in neighborhoods across this state. Our coalition is concerned about three things, primarily. One is the reduction in civic education in the classrooms. With the current emphasis on math and science and reading, time for civic education has been reduced in classrooms across the state. This means that time that is spent on civic ed must be very high quality, it has to be very engaging, and there must be a lot of opportunities outside of the classroom as well. Second is the growing civic education gap. Insufficient civic learning opportunities in socially and economically disadvantaged schools and neighborhoods prevent youth from being adequately prepared for citizenship. Those groups that are the most socially and economically disadvantaged have the lowest levels of civic knowledge and are therefore politically disadvantaged. This is a huge concern for our coalition. The literature on the civic instruction is by and large pessimistic about how to narrow those gaps. And there was a Circle report recently, well, it's a few years old now, that was focused on kids voting. Pull it here. It's from somewhere. It's from 2006, and it referenced this, and it talked about kids voting, one of the programs in the coalition. It says, "Kids voting appears to provide an added boost for minority and low-income students. They found this to be the case with Hispanic students in Colorado, and that replicated findings they found in 2004 from kids from California." It also talked about low-income students, and it said that kids voting defies these expectations, at least for some outcomes. The equalizing effects occur because kids voting helps to transform norms for communication in minority and low-income families and students. And our third concern is technology. I think we are all very aware of the impact of technology and the rapid changes. It's drastically changed how we communicate, how we gather information, and how citizens interact with decision-making. There is a tremendous need for high civic content delivered to young people in various ways. Increasingly, teachers and others, parents included, are utilizing the internet for educational materials. Many of these materials on the internet are rife with inaccuracy, bias, and often the materials are designed to promote a cause or an ideology. Without a strong civic culture supporting parents, teachers, community youth workers, students, Minnesotans will ultimately pay the price. Our coalition has used past legacy funds to provide civic education opportunities to communities across the state. We've reached many un- and underserved communities statewide, and we want to reach many more. Our organizations have more than 90 years of collective civic education programming experience, and deliver programming that is frequently cited as high-quality model programs, including in the recent document, Making Civics Count, Citizenship Education for a New Generation. Many of the programs we have here in Minnesota that were expanded through the legacy funds are cited in this book. So our Civic Education Coalition is focused on three things. We are creating civic learning opportunities for students, we enrich teacher capacities, and we're building statewide networks to really scale up these efforts that we know are effective.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Bloom, and I am the Director of Learning Law and Democracy Foundation. And I would like to speak with you about the accomplishments that have been made possible with legacy funding over the last couple of years. But first, I want to share with you a vision of our work. And I'm going to ask you to open up your imaginations at the moment. I'd like you to imagine a house. It has several rooms. It's two stories tall. It's clearly been around for a while. It's been added on to. There have been several generations of people living in the house. For the moment, ignore the people living in the house and perhaps their pets, their animals, and focus on the bricks and mortar of the house. It has a cornerstone and building blocks. It has wings and maybe even a pillar or two. There's space in the house, and the space is allocated to different purposes. We have a bathroom, we have a kitchen, we have a laundry room, we have a living room, we might have a man cave. The house requires maintenance to make sure it survives for the next generation. It needs tender, loving care. Now imagine the house is our government. Our Constitution provides a blueprint. We have rules for the use of the rooms and rules that govern our behavior. This house, this structure, represents our civic heritage. It is our government, it is our processes, it's the rules we live by, the way we get along, it's what we hand down to the next generation. Civic education teaches about this house. It teaches the skills that are needed to run the house. You might have in this house family meetings, meetings with roommates to consider the rules that we're living under. You think about plans to maintain and repair the house. In a home, you might address issues of fairness and even due process. And if any of you have had children in elementary school, you are very familiar with the phrase, "But let me tell my side of the story." These are the big ideas of civic education. It is what we do. Our work is critical to the preservation of our heritage because we teach about the house that is our form of government. We teach about rights and responsibilities of the people who are responsible for this experiment in self-government. Now, if we go back to the people in the house for a moment, over time, the residents have changed. Maybe from Sweden in 1953 when my family arrived here, or from Somalia today. People move in and out of the house. They put up artwork, they decorate. They give a personal touch to the house. They move on. I like to think of a tapestry in the house. It's hanging in the living room and it stays with the house because it's really too large to move. Every generation has added its bit to the weaving. Sometimes it's a subtle thread. Sometimes it's a big fat yarn. It makes the house interesting, but does not change the house. The people in the house interact with the house. And when we talk about having citizens and teaching students how to interact with their government, that's what we're talking about. They give the house meaning. The stories of what happens in the house are important. They show how a room may have changed. If we think about for a moment our Minnesota House of Government, one recent change in our house would be the legacy room with all of the various projects that have been funded with this fund. Examples of the way our government operates, how our rules are applied in our lives, all of these help us understand our house, but our house stays the same. Our civic culture respects this house. We expect it to be good government, and we work to maintain it. Our goal is that we all would feel that the house is ours and that we are welcome and comfortable in it. We have used our legacy funds to support civic education that teaches about our house and helps develop the knowledge and skills needed to preserve it. We teach about what we all share, our constitutional democracy, the one thing we all have in common, not about how we are different. E pluribus unum, out of many, one. It is the culture we all share. Although civic education can be expanded to include a lot of things, engagement, volunteering, service learning, for the purpose of the legacy funds, we are suggesting a definition that comes from the Minnesota Center for Social Studies Education, which is a partnership between the Minnesota Historical Society and the Minnesota Department of Education. This definition is on the front sheet of your fact sheet. And I'd like to spend a few minutes talking about our accomplishments with the legacy funds. We have more detail on the fact sheet on the back side if you'd like to look at that. But here's a quick look at how we look at our work. It comes in two big categories. One is retail and one is wholesale. Retail, these are programs we do with kids directly. Wholesale, these are programs where we impact the adults that who then in turn turn around and work with kids. So under retail, some of our major accomplishments, some of our highlights, our 1,000 students experienced significant impact. And when I think about significant impact, I'm talking about hours of learning. The YMCA, Youth Conference, Project Citizen, Candidate Forums, We the People, Constitution Smackdown, just to name a few. On top of this 1,000 youth, we have 41,000 youth from across the state who experienced authentic voting experiences during the past election from cities all over Minnesota, Brainerd, Ely, Albany, Duluth, Thief River Falls, Virginia, just to name a few. And many of these students come from underserved populations. Actually, I think most of the youth in the state are underserved. Our retail efforts give us maximum ability to increase diversity. We can select the communities that we want to work with where we're going to extend our outreach efforts. For example, the YMCA Youth Conference, 41% of the students were students of color. Project Citizen, which will be here at the Capitol May 3rd, there's about 29% students of color. Kids Voting Minneapolis has 70% students of color, and St. Paul has 76% students of color. You might think that our students of color population is mostly in the metro area, but you know, as well as everyone else, that our changing society has minority populations, people of students of color, increasing dramatically in a lot of our more rural areas. We are a statewide project. We reach out to all those communities. Now onto wholesale. What is wholesale? That's when we are working with the adults who turn around and work with kids. These are teachers, they are volunteers, they are group leaders from places like 4-H, Girl Scouts, they are parents. For example, each week, hundreds of educators access high-quality vetted lessons, nonpartisan lessons, on the legacy-funded teachingcivics.org website. These materials are used then with an estimated 15,000 students. Nearly 200 Minnesota teachers have received professional development using lessons created to teach about Minnesota's constitution and government, reaching approximately 27,000 students. Kids Voting Affiliates, they do the hard work of coordinating local programs. And for example, their candidate forums in Thief River Falls for 550 students. We create tools to help communities improve civic education, and one of them created this past year was a civic assessment self-assessment. So communities can look at what are we offering our youth and what can we do to make it better. The numbers become a blur unless you've got a calculator and you're totaling up. The big picture is with legacy funds, we reached over 70,000 students, and that doesn't include students who were able to use the website lessons. With legacy funds, we have made a difference, and we are seeking funds to continue to make a difference. We're seeking $500,000 in 2014 and $500,000 in 2015 to develop new and expanded opportunities for Minnesota's K-12 youth. More information is on our back sheet. Keep in mind that every year we have a new group of kids to reach. Our goals and dreams for the next 2 years: increase the number of students benefiting directly from legacy-funded programs. Expand statewide kids voting by adding another 20,000 youth. Double the number of teachers through a new program called Each One, Reach One. We're asking teachers to bring a teacher. Promote the use of the assessment to persuade schools across the state to improve their civic education offerings. Develop a youth advisory council to make sure digital civic education opportunities are high quality, youth-driven, and kid-friendly. Respond to teacher requests, to parents' requests that are asking for increased resources to use outside of the classroom. Double the number of lessons that we have on teachingcivics.org and spread the word. Our young people will inherit our state and our world with all of its problems and blessings. It is our job to ensure they know how to carry forward the republic they will inherit. Thank you for your past support for civic education and the opportunity to have input on the future use of the funds generated by the Legacy Amendment. Thank you.
Both of you. Representative Berloff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And a few questions. How do you contact, I assume you contact schools to get this material to them. How did you do that, and how many actual schools take advantage of this?
Are you referencing a specific program or just all of the work that we do? Because between the three programs, we partner and we work very closely together. We have a pretty broad net of teachers, school district professionals, superintendents that we connect with that we've built relationships over the course of a decade or two. So a lot of it is relationship based, and you know we all do similar work in terms of connecting with schools. So is that what you're asking?
Madam Chair.
Yeah, Representative.
Thank you. Partly. Okay. What I'm looking for, but I mean you have to. I'm glad you've built a network so that's easy. But you need to to get this information out. That this is available, and just wondering how you do that, and is it then? Do you have things available that you sell to them, or what? How does that work?
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, we use every tool available. So, for example, I have a workshop on Tuesday, and I have sent emails. I used a purchased email service just to get the word out. Last week and a half ago, the Minnesota Council for the Social Studies met in St. Cloud. There were 350 teachers there. We had an exhibit space where we had flyers that explained all the programs offerings, and we had a sign that said this is funded by the Legacy Amendment. We get on the phone. We tell people about it. One of the things that we're trying to push with Each One, Reach One is to give responsibility sort of to teachers, and many of whom are facing retirement in the next decade, to bring someone else along. So we have print materials that we use to promote the programs that advertise what the Legacy does. We use word of mouth. We use our board of directors. We use, and to answer your final question, I'm not aware that any of us sell anything. We actually try to provide access to workshops for very minimum fee. Sometimes I'll charge $25 just to make, provide the incentive to attend. Oftentimes I try to give that back when they're done so they can take the $25 and go buy some resources that they might have learned about. But we tend not to make money nor to charge money. And in terms of our student programs, and my programs, we don't charge the students anything to participate. And I believe that the YMCA charges for youth and government, but the programs that are funded by Legacy, they are aimed at a different audience, and I'm not aware that they charge anything.
Madam Chair?
Representative Erdahl.
So you provide programs then to schools and others free of charge. Do you have any idea how many school districts in Minnesota take advantage of your programs?
On a daily basis, Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, on a daily basis, I have 80 to 100 teachers access the website. And so if I drill down into the Google Analytics report, I could tell you The list is pretty extensive. I think I checked today, and there were, 67 towns. I don't get into a specific school, but towns that have accessed the page today. Any one of our programs has a different group of students and teachers that are participating in it, but I know I have in my email list about 1,200 teachers.
And I would add to that, Madam Chair and Representative Erdahl, for kids voting, we are present in every congressional district across the state, and it's hard for us to identify communities because we have some communities like Ely that are smaller, and then we have cities like St. Paul. So I should have tabulated, but if I had to guess, I'd say of communities that participated in the last election, I would probably guess between 40 and 50, but those range, you know, like could be a big city or a smaller town. So.
Okay, Madam Chairman? Well, thank you. That provides, I think, some at least a basis of information for members here to analyze a little bit better. I do believe you're doing good work, and just kind of sum up by letting us know again, what is the total that you're asking for this year, and what did you get in the last biennium?
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, in the last biennium we received 500. No, I'm not going to say. The first year of the biennium, we received $210,000 of the $250,000 that the legislature appropriated. And in the second year, we received $125,000 of the $250,000 appropriated for civic education by the legislature. This year, this next biennium, we're asking for an increase to $500,000 each year for a total of $1 million for the biennium.
Thank you.
One of the things I've been at, do you get any private funding? Do these groups get any matching funding?
Madam Chair, we fundraise a lot. So, yes, we receive private funding. We receive individual contributions. I operate on some federal grants, some national organization grants. I have to tell you, when we compare our work with some of the other social sciences, I always have to laugh about this because if you look at the other social sciences, social studies includes economics, and they tend to be funded by bankers and business people, and the History Center, the History Education with the Historical Society, the geography folks get National Geographic funding. And when it comes down to civics and government, the natural constituency that might provide funding is the people and the legislature. And I'd like to invite all of you to our collaborative fundraiser on September 11th, the week of September 11th for Constitution Day at Brits Pub. We'd love to have you.
Well, one of the things I've been looking at is putting not necessarily a requirement, but a concept of looking at matching funding for these programs in terms of looking at the granting that's being done. And so any suggestions as to how that might be worded or how that we might do that would be beneficial to your organizations. We're not trying to make it an absolute, I'm not trying to make it an absolute requirement, but I'm trying to make it, because I know how powerful both the fact that this state money available is to get private money, and how much the people who give state money are ecstatic when they see that what they've done has incented some more private money to come. So that's something that we're kind of, that at least I'm looking at as we start to put the legacy bill together.
Madam Chair, I have used that kind of tool in a number of occasions where I've challenged people to, and by saying, you know, I remember working at Hamlin Law School when I had George Latimer was the dean, and he issued a letter saying, I'll match anything you can raise in the next 2 weeks. And so I'm used to using that. I think one of my reactions is we struggle for every dollar that we raise from the private world. And so if we had to have a dollar-for-dollar match, I think, you know, I'm just guessing, but we would probably end up spending most of our 40, 50, 60 hours a week trying to raise that match. It's my only concern.
Is one disappointment I have with all of your groups is that when I look at kids voting, I think you ought to be more interested in having kids really voting
And, you know, I've never seen any support from you for lowering the voting age.
Well, maybe we can get on that.
Representative.
Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, next week when we do our workshop, it's on a strategy or a lesson on lowering the voting age and having students think about what goes into that and also comparing how it's done around the world. So we have not ignored it. We just tend not to get into advocating a particular point of view. We try to stay neutral from, but I would agree. I think students can be very educated by. Okay.
There are many countries that are ahead of us, like both Iran and Cuba.
Madam Chair, do you feel it's proper for them to be playing up to the new chairman?
Well, I expect your support when we do it again. But any other comments or questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. The next group is Global Classroom. This is the subject of a bill that's being presented by Representative Allen. So we're going to start with Representative Allen, who's going to start by introducing them to us. Representative
Thank you,
Allen.
In presenting House File 1535. May I start? Or?
We didn't print out the bill, but that's okay. Just tell us.
The United Nations Association of Minnesota is seeking $50,000 appropriation in fiscal year 2014 and $50,000 in fiscal year 2015. Funds will be used to conduct the Global Classrooms program to help Minnesota's youth become actively engaged citizens in the global environment. The organization currently provides statewide curricular materials and other services no cost, but they are now going to be expanding to bringing Global Classrooms to all eighth grade classrooms in Minneapolis. And we have a number of testifiers here who said they would be very brief. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. No, members note that there is a handout that you have dealing with this program. Okay. Testifiers? Just announce, say your name and.
I'm Bob Vlotten with the United Nations Association. I grew up in Northfield, but I spent my professional life in the Foreign Service, concluding as the American Ambassador in Rwanda. Back in Minnesota, I've been trying to encourage through all the organizations I know, and the most effective being the United Nations Association of Minnesota. The Global Classrooms program is the most successful that I have seen in bringing international issues to middle school and to high school students. Global Classrooms, concluding with the Model UN, is a program of the United Nations Association. And the Twin Cities has been selected as one of 10 cities in the United States to participate in this program. There are 14 cities overseas that are also part of a program bringing the Model UN and international education to our classrooms. Our purpose is to provide global studies and a Model UN experience to inner city youth who often cannot afford the other available Model UN programs. Our program began about 10 years ago with a grant from the United Nations Association of the U.S., but it is now almost entirely locally funded. With Minnesota foundations have helped, but the real participation is volunteers, teachers, outstanding young staff, and some college interns. We have also benefited enormously from the Twin Cities colleges. They've provided space for up to 500 students in a Model UN, and they have even provided luncheons for the kids. I must say that's very popular. Hamlin was the first to get involved, and Hamlin remains our strongest supporter. But we're also supported by McAllister, St. Thomas, Augsburg, the University of Minnesota, with space for our Model UN programs. The most encouraging result of the program has been the enthusiasm of the students. For the Model UNs, they dress up. Ties for the guys, high heels for the girls. and they are full participants in the program. They'll remember what they are learning. We started in St. Paul, where the social studies coordinator offered the program to teachers if they wished, and St. Paul does it that way. The teachers and their students responded enthusiastically, and some of them are still guiding their program in St. Paul schools. With the success in St. Paul, we have offered to try to bring this program into Minneapolis. The trial worked so well that the Minneapolis school system has now invited us to bring the program to all 8th grade classes. What an opportunity. But in addition, several suburban schools and some outstate schools have expressed interest in joining. Because the purpose of the program is to provide this experience free for inner city youth, we have arranged a small per student fee for the outstate schools. Expansion to other schools from the small program we have had is going to require more staff, more interns, and obviously more money. And we thank you for your interest. Thank you, Representative.
Representative Murphy.
Excuse me, but do they have to wear high heels?
No, they don't have to wear ties either. We have tried to collect ties from Rotary clubs and other places so the guys can wear ties. The high-heeled shoes is totally an option that they want to show off because they are having a good time. Further, Fatima will continue.
My name is Fatima Kramali-Welji, and I am the coordinator for the Global Classrooms program. I'd like to just give you a brief overview to help you understand a bit more about how Global Classrooms works. So there are four main program components to this. As you can see, the curriculum, conferences, professional development for teachers, classroom training sessions, and the Speakers Bureau. The curriculum really tries to focus on helping to develop research, writing, and speaking skills, as well as promoting active, globally engaged leadership. And you should all have a copy of the curriculum as well in front of you if you'd like to take a look at that as well. Each year we have a different focus for the curriculum that ties back to important global issues, and this year that focus is on poverty. The poverty topic is then divided into subtopics, which are discussed in each of the different committees at our UN conferences. So, for example, the General Assembly this year is discussing urbanization of poverty. The World Health Organization is focusing on poverty and maternal health. And the Security Council is discussing poverty and conflict in Afghanistan. The Model UN conferences, we've had one so far this year, which was the high school conference at McAllister, attended by 5 schools, 164 students. You can see an image of that there. The reason we've only had one so far is because the conferences tend to fall more in the spring semester during the end of the year. Teachers like to use it kind of as a, you know, it's a nice close to the year to end with this conference. So upcoming conferences, you can see there's a lot more going on. We have 3 state ones that are coming up. Our high school conference at Hamline on April 9th has about 250 registrants. Middle school conference, we're looking at over 500 students. That's usually our largest one. Spanish conference, about 200 students at the University of Minnesota School of Management. And then we have a couple of other school conferences as well. Those are where we just hold them within the school for students. Usually if it's a larger group, they just want to keep it in the school, it's easier. We have those available as well. The next component is professional development, which we offer for teachers. We usually do 2 sessions a year. One focuses on introducing the program and kind of going over the curriculum so the teachers are more comfortable with that. And then the second one is going more into detail with the topic for the teachers that they can take that information back to their students. And then we're also looking at doing summer training to get ready for next year. Then we also have classroom visits, and these are, there are 2 components to that. One is where we send trainers to the classrooms to help teachers teach the students about Model UN. We have about 100 sessions of those already scheduled for this year and more more to come. And then the Speakers Bureau consists of 19 available speakers, and these are individuals with a lot of experience globally who can come into classrooms and speak to students to give that perspective as well. Looking forward, we are looking forward to a great and exciting year ahead, hopefully trying to expand the program to other schools. And in particular, we have a couple of school districts that we've been talking to regarding partnerships. One, as mentioned earlier, was a Minneapolis school district, which is looking to have us come into all their eighth grades, eighth grade programs, and this would add about 20 school conferences per year. And then we've also been speaking with St. Paul about possibly adding Model UN to their curriculum as an option, and that would be for both eighth grade and then high school 10th and 12th grade as well. So this would increase our the number of students that we expect to serve from about, it was 2,900 last year, because we have the totals for that, and that would be doubling to about 6,000 is what we expect. So we're looking forward to hopefully doing that, and of course that'll require more training sessions, trainers, and funding for the expansion as well.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and representatives of the committee, and thanks so much for having me. Eleanor Roosevelt once said, the future belongs to those who believe...
You need to give your name for the tape.
Oh, I have it later, but okay. Anna Schmiel,
okay.
Senior at Edina High School.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Eleanor Roosevelt once said, the future belongs to those who believe in the beauty of their dreams. As the first representative of the United States to the United Nations, the sentiment in her statement remains the cornerstone of what the United Nations and subsequently Model United Nations stands for. I'm a senior at Edina High School, and I have been part of Model United Nations for 3 years. Model United Nations has changed my life, and this is not an exaggeration. When I was a 10th grader, I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life. Although I have always enjoyed learning about current events, other cultures, and other ideas, I didn't know how to actively pursue this interest. In the course of attending 9 Model UN conferences, I have represented Myanmar, Nicaragua, Yemen, Liberia, Algeria, Mozambique, Finland, Brazil, and Nigeria. I've attended 5 Model United Nations conferences through Global Classrooms, through Hamline University and McAllister College. When we first started Model United Nations at my class and my school, we had 24 students, and that was 3 years ago. Now we have 120 students. We had a trainer from Global Classrooms come in 3 years ago, and she really allowed us to develop our program. Because of Model United Nations, I now know what I want to do with my life. After being a delegate on the Commission on the Status of Women twice, I know I want to be a human rights lawyer for repressed women around the world. I now understand the importance of being multilingual and plan on learning Arabic and Persian in college. A lot of people ask me, isn't Model United Nations just for people interested in politics and international relations? In reality, the skills of diplomacy, cultural understanding, tolerance, and public speaking are applicable to every 21st century citizen and job. When my generation grows up, they will have to face a crippling economy, environmental devastation, countries fighting for natural resources, disease, socioeconomic stratification, countries fighting on the basis of ideals and intolerance. In order to combat these problems, countries and people must band together. Every professional will need to be equipped with skills that allow for global communication. My generation's doctors will need to understand how HIV/AIDS affects the economies of poor countries in order to develop a vaccine. My generation's engineers will need to work with many countries in order to develop alternative sources of energy. I believe that it's never too early to start learning. Incorporating Model UN ideals in the classrooms of Minneapolis and St. Paul public schools will allow kids to be exposed to the real world early on. They will begin to understand the source of global problems. Understanding is the first step towards change. Model UN is applicable to being a citizen of the world. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Ms. Schmiel. Don't go away so fast. Madam Chair?
Yes?
Ms. Schmiel?
No, she's in the same.
Yeah.
We're just switching.
First, I want to commend you on your well-spoken comments and just ask a question.
Just a warning, he's our teacher. So.
And that's why I'm asking a history question. Do you know who the Minnesotan was who signed the first UN charter?
Harold Stassen.
You get an A for the day. Yes. Harold Stassen. Who I did interview and ask that question of.
Okay. Going on. Okay, Madam Chair and representatives, my name is Randy Markison, and I am the co-chair of the Education Committee for Minnesota Global Classrooms. I have to say this is quite a hard act to follow, so I'll be brief. As a result of our partnership with the Minneapolis Public Schools and the expansion of the existing program in St. Paul and a pilot project in the outstate district of Westbrook Walnut Grove, Global Classrooms expenses will significantly increase. We'll be hiring more Model UN trainers in order to support the increased demand for programs. We'll add professional development sessions for teachers new to the program and also to help those who've been in the program for a while. We'll support them throughout the academic year. Additional program materials will be required to expand cultural knowledge. We'll also need some increased administrative support for Global Classrooms and their consultants. We will have some travel expenses and technology expenses for outstate training, and we will continue to develop and improve the evaluation materials that we use to assess the program to show the achievement of the standards and benchmarks required by the state of Minnesota. So I thank you for your attention. We hope you will help us in advancing and extending the educational leadership and cultural opportunities that create global citizens. So, any other questions?
Thank you. Representative Murphy?
Madam Chair, I just had a question about the outstate training. What do you mean by that?
Well, we have been working with Westbrook Walnut Grove, a small school district in southwest Minnesota, and we will have to have some trainers actually go to the district, but also work with technology to train their teachers and have some conferences maybe online. We're exploring all those options.
Any other? What is the total budget of Global Classroom?
It is, just a second. The 2012-2013 budget was $146,190. We estimate with the expansion that the 2013-14 budget will be $254,000.
One of the issues that we have with legacy appropriations is that according to the Constitution, they're supposed to supplement and not supplant existing funding. So that's kind of, you know, so it's not that we need a totally new program, but we really kind of have to see how legacy program is this supplementing and not supplanting, that we're not just replacing some existing program. So
I guess I would say that Global Classrooms enhances programs that are already in the curriculum and programs that are mandated by the state.
Well, I guess the question, though, is if Global Classrooms is an existing program, how is, if we do our appropriation, how is that going to be a supplement and not a supplanter?
Madam Chair, may I be excused to present another bill in policy?
Okay, sure. Thank you. Yes.
I guess I would say that we're expanding the program to serve as many students as we can.
Representative McDonald?
Okay. Trista okay. Tells me it's capacity building. We're not replacing any funding.
Representative McDonald?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious on this particular bill that Representative Allen has. How does that deal in with our Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund? How does the allocation, if the bill passes, how does that apply to our heritage and cultural
Well, the bill is asking for funding, and so it would probably come here. I don't know if there's any other. It would be a grant through the arts and cultural history part of the legacy funding. Probably put it through some larger we have to look at the structure of the bill from the last 2 years. Representative, our two chairs are here to tell us, but as I understand it, we probably put it through a larger organization like the Humanities Council or the History Center. And I think that they've done it. I'm not sure what they've done in terms of specifying specific things, or if they've just, or how they've done it. Representative Erdahl, do you want to say something?
Well, yes, Madam Chair, the Humanities Center is, yeah, as we've learned before, ran the civics education courses through them. Through there, they have some criteria and parameters, and if we were to fund this, I would suggest going through the Humanities Center.
And it would be part of that proportion of the budget.
It would.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, we would appropriate a certain amount of money to the Humanities Center, and then from that they would direct to the various educational entities that are requesting money.
Madam Chair. So my question just is, how is it applicable to the Legacy's Constitution when it deals with our arts and culture, the work that they do, the global classrooms curriculum? How is that applicable to what our Constitution states we should be allocating the funds for?
Well, we're supposed to have the copy of the Constitution with us at all times. We can, what?
It's in our guide.
It's in our guide. I remember I wanted that on the, Okay, you pull out the legislative guide and you look at arts education, arts access, and to preserve Minnesota's history and cultural heritage. We've already heard how Minnesota's history really had one of the first signers of the United Nations Charter on. So we're certainly tied up with that.
So, Madam Chair, so the work that they are doing, the Global Classrooms, they're teaching Minnesota history, is that correct?
History and cultural heritage. It's a pretty broad term, I think.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Shouldn't our schools be doing that already with our tax dollars without having to allocate more funds to this group here?
Well,
no offense. I mean, isn't that the duty of our classrooms?
That should be done for both arts education and, you know, other things too. We've had education programs that come for, you know, programs that are kind of outside of the school that's not in the regular school curriculum.
Madam Chair?
Okay. Well,
so just to follow up, so if for some reason this does not get approved, the bill, so we won't be teaching arts and cultural history in our classrooms, is that correct?
You know, one of the things that maybe Representative, Hausman is next, but one of the things we've also done a certain amount of funding from this is libraries. And one of the things is libraries are very important instruments. You could say, you know, why aren't the local units of government funding libraries? And they are. But I guess some of the grants that we made to libraries were kind of an extension of that. So, anyway, again, at any point, we've got these two experts here who could tell us what we've done in the past, as opposed to me, who's just the first timer and don't have any idea of what I'm doing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, frankly, Representative McDonald, you could probably make that argument on everything we're doing in the legacy bill that, you know, could, you know, local government or state government be funding this in some other way. They could, but for whatever reasons, in certain areas they have chosen not to. And so, you know, I understand where you're going, and, you know, this one you may have some, you know, I'm not going to make an editorial judgment right now, but you may be closer to the point on some than on others. But I'll just sum up by saying, and we can talk more offline about this, Representative McDonald, but generally you can make the argument you just made for everything.
Representative Hess.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I learned something the other day as a result of some of the discussions following up from previous meetings. And it shows how long I've been out of the education circuit. What I discovered was that our State Department of Education doesn't even have what we used to call as a social studies expert anymore, who might be there serving as a resource to the schools. And then I further learned, and maybe all of the rest of you already knew this, I somehow thought we had like prescribed either textbooks or curriculum or something, and I'm told no, all we have now are standards. And on something like this, social studies, the teachers might be told, go online and find lessons. Oh. And that they would actually go online and say, Bill of Rights lessons and see what comes up. It's quite an alarming thing. But it's a very, we've moved a very different way in terms of our State Department and what we've what we provide for schools. So it was as a result of our last meeting, it was quite a learning experience for me.
Yeah. Okay, Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, I don't want to belabor the subject either, but I think the testimony that we received from the student, one of the things that the legacy money is supposed to do based on heritage or custom and usage kind of things was to bring something to more people, underserved people. And I think Nishmeel's testimony, senior in high school whose life has been changed by an experience that she volunteered for, and now that has framed what her whole goals in her future life might be. And if we think that a program that's been serving 500 Minnesota students could be enhanced by some dollars that in the next 5 years could serve 1,500 Minnesota students that were having life-changing experiences, I think then that would, triple maybe into the next future. And we're changing lives. We're having connectivism. We're bringing more people that are using Minnesota resources to help other Minnesotans. And I think that's one of the goals that are in the guide. But maybe all the students aren't as directed as Ms. Schmiel has been. But as a participant in teaching role for a program like this over 50 years ago and seeing the impact on students that were involved in this role-playing representation programs at the very beginning, it's a value. It's a good value. It's a good thing. Now, when it comes time to see if we're going to conclude it or not, that's something else. But I think it meets the constitutional parameters.
I'll give you an example that I had to sort of be convinced that. I was a little shocked to see in the last legacy bill this appropriation going to the arts appropriation going to the Department of Agriculture for county fairs, and that just seemed, I couldn't see how that fit in. But I think we've had some very, very good testimony on that from the people who were involved in it. And, you know, part of the thing was hiring a spectacular staff person to run it, you know, and do an inaugural session. That must have been very difficult, but that seems to have been very successful. I guess we'll see more of it. But I think, you know, I think there are new things that we're going to be looking at, and we shouldn't close our eyes to them right away. Representative McDonald.
Well, a couple lessons learned from today's debate. I'm sure we're going to close this up. There's no doubt that the testimony by Ms. Schmiel was impressive, and I presume
and you couldn't have done that at that age at all.
No, I could not. No, she was very good, and I presume that you're going to do very well in life and be very successful to make a better Minnesota a better world. Certainly. However, and you're not going to like me when I say, perhaps we failed then this global initiative here from the United Nations and or this group not funding it from the last previous years when she couldn't even remember that Harold Stattson or know that he was our youngest governor in the state of Minnesota and one of our founding fathers here, so to speak, of the United Nations. So we either need to allocate more money so we can maintain the heritage of Harold Stattson, who, thankful to his work, this you're here, was our youngest governor, and or the organization failed in letting you know that he was one of the founding members here of the United Nations and our youngest governor.
The problem was we hadn't given them any money. That's what that was showing.
There you go.
That answer was
there's
showing that they needed
right
to
there.
Have
more
money.
We'll remember. Who I photographed, okay. By the way, I had the luxury of photographing, and I'll close, and I won't say another word the rest of the meeting. Four of our great governors, from Arne Carlson to Harold Stattson to Levander Anderson to
Al Cui.
Yeah, four of them all together at a function, and Harold Stattson was a fine diplomat and a great gentleman, fun to work with.
Well, in the previous years of the legislature, one of the great Kahn-Krinke collaborations was the naming of the revenue building, the Stassen Building. So.
I didn't know that. See, I failed to.
Right. And we could have asked you what legislator named the Stassen Building, and you wouldn't have gotten it. Okay. Thanks. Sorry to get you involved, but thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
And we'll be considering it. Any other ones? Oh, yes. Public comment. Someone wanted to give us some public comment. We have a few minutes left for that. Someone asked her. I know. It's all right. Go treat them with the stupid stuff. Okay, I don't know if you're on today's material or what.
Well, I talked with Mike a couple of days ago.
Okay.
And
you have to give your name.
Yeah, okay. My name is Robert Austin. I'm from New Prague, Minnesota. And I'll use the term, I'm kind of an inactive member at the present time of the Sportsman for Change in Minnesota Waterfall Association. And I'd like to discuss the Lessard Sams Council and then also this legislation that's been introduced. It was last week, the 207A2. On the Lessard Council, it's a council made up of 12 people, and it works, and I feel very strong that the reason it works is eight of them are citizens or civilians that have done a very good job and are interested in what they're doing. Yeah, I think I'm correct in saying that Jim Nichols, who's the state auditor, gave this organization top marks in the state for conducting their business. And also the council has a process of examining projects or vetting projects that come to them from different organizations, and they've done an excellent job. Through the Lessard Sams Council, the sportsmen have got something that we've never really had in the past, and that's a permanent source of revenue and money for game, fish, and wildlife projects. And I really feel very strongly that this is something that's working, and this. And that Lessard Council should be kind of left alone, so to speak, to put it in this term. You know, it's something that works, and you know, don't fix it. And that brings me to my other point of the discussion of this this House file. It's 207A2, which I'm not particularly happy with. It's, you know, where you've got $6.4 million coming out of the Game, Fish, and Wildlife funding that's going to be going to the Met Council.
Let me exactly say what that funding is for. The receipt shall be deposited in the Outdoor Heritage Fund and may be spent only to restore, protect, and enhance wetlands, prairies, forests, and habitat for fish, game, and wildlife. So that's the constitutional language that we're dealing with.
Okay, but what we have here, if I think I'm correct in saying this, that we have a situation here where the Metropolitan Council is, you know, going for funding out of the Game, Fish, and Wildlife, which I question that there, and I know it's speaking from the...
I read the language. I think everything that we've looked at follows the language that I've just read, which is that's the language in the Constitution.
So you're saying that if this takes place where you're going to take for the Met Council and put this into... you know, take money out of the Game, Fish, and Wildlife funding and use it for the...
No. It's not... It doesn't any place say Game, Fish, and Wildlife. It says to restore, protect, and enhance wetlands, prairies, forests, and habitat for fish, game, and wildlife. So anything that benefits that... Well, I'm sorry. I shouldn't be interrupting you. Why don't you continue? I just...
Well, okay. I'm just... This is a... kind of a pie chart that my daughter put together when we were, 2008, putting all this together, trying to get this whole legacy thing passed. And I used it quite a bit at Game Fair and trying to explain to people exactly what the legacy thing was about, and other gentlemen were, and people were using it too. Where you got 33% going to waters, you got 33% going to Game, Fish, and Wildlife. There's 14.25% going to parks and trails, and then you've got 19.75% going to the arts. And where I'm coming from is that I see this, that the arts here are taking money out of the Game, Fish, and Wildlife funding. Now, am I wrong on this?
I don't understand that, so you might explain it better.
Well, but okay, where you've got...
The Constitution states that. 19 points... So... The pie chart sounds like it gave us the constitutional numbers. So they're not taking... That was what the people voted for.
Okay, the $6.4 million that was passed, I understand, last Thursday was...
Not in this committee. It's
no,
coming
it, right. I understand that. I wanted to go to that, speak at that committee, but I had some car issues and so on. But where is that $6.4 million going to come from?
The Outdoor Heritage Fund for habitat restoration, which is specifically what that fund is for.
When you use the term Outdoor Heritage Fund, in my mind, that's the Lessard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Fund.
Yes.
Okay, but then why are we taking money out of that fund and the parks are using it?
Well, they're looking at the program. One of the things we have to look at is the kind of programs that in the past that the Lessard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council has sent us. And in this current one, there's a park program right in the city of Brainerd that does the very same thing, restores habitat in a park. There's also, in last year's census, what was the park in last year's? The LaSalle.
John Ward Park.
and this committee has not voted on it, so we will be voting on it and we will be looking at that. But I will also point out that in the last bill there was the LaSalle Park? What is the name?
That was before,
Let me have someone who's worked on the bill before
about it. Each of the last couple of years, there has been habitat funding that has gone to a park system, I guess. One, LaSalle, and the other, I can't remember John Ward's park's name right now, but
Mississippi Northwoods.
Okay, Northwoods. Thank you. That's indelibly burned in some minds around here. But and this has happened. But you know, this is a possibility this year, that it's a proposal that has not been approved. You're right now, as I understand it, Lessard Sams has not looked favorably. And the difference, I think, is that these other two projects, Lessard Sams had approved of.
Okay, you're talking like, is that the Mississippi Northwoods?
Northwoods, okay. Yes, and also LaSalle, which is in Hubbard County.
And then in this center, there's one in Brainerd that's right in the center of the city of Brainerd.
This one may be, Madam Chair, a little bit different in that, is and I'm not on Lessard Sams, but who, Representative Lilly, would you care to...
He's carrying the bill.
But would you care to explain Lessard Sam's position on this particular item?
My bill was passed. 207 has the amendment attached. It came out of Chair Wagenius' committee with the amendment attached to spend bottom line money on the metro proposal, and a couple days ago, the Lessard Sams group met, and they, realizing that there's some money on the bottom line, they decided to leave a 5% reserve and to spend the money above that. I think it was like an additional maybe $4 million, I'm sorry, I don't know the exact number, three something, on RIM. So they've never done that before in the history of the bill, where they've modified their proposal and then offered another proposal. Although, in fairness, there is a reserve this year, and I'm not sure every year we've had reserves, because so it's a debate. I don't know where it goes. It's going to be up to, you know, it's technically in our hand, the legislative body, and so I don't.
Okay. Well, we are over time, and Representative Murphy wants to make a comment, and then, sir, we'll let you make some final comments.
Okay, just one question to Leon. Leon, is anybody,
yes,
anybody else from the hunting and fishing community spoken up on this issue?
Madam Chair,
the bill is not before our committee. When the bill is before our committee, of course, it will be open to public testimony, and we'll listen to people at that time. We just did this to accommodate you because you were coming down today. But the subject really isn't before us, and we're also out of time. So if you have any closing comments, we'd like to hear them. But Representative Murphy, do you want to say something?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to give historical comment that the Lessard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council has never been shy in expressing how the Clean Water Fund or the Parks and Trails Fund should be spent, or what projects would that come to their purview should really apply over or fit better in the clean water or fit better in the parks and trails. And so I think, just as the Lessard Sams is an advisory committee to the legislature, the Clean Water Fund is an advisory to the legislature, the Parks and Trails Fund is an advisory to the legislature, and the Arts Board and History Society is an advisory to the legislature on how the funds should be made. We should consider every proposal that's brought before us. And the comments of the gentleman should be considered.
Matt, do you have any? We are over time. So
yeah, thank
any
you.
Final comments to? Okay, thank you very much. And thank you for coming. Meeting adjourned.